I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Jackson County is really hopping these days. Between fluctuating property assessments and the courthouse renovation, the county's missteps and triumphs are keeping people talking. This hour, we'll talk with Jackson County Executive Mike Sanders about what residents can expect now that the property reassessment deadline has passed. Later, we'll look at a series of violent incidents on city buses where a bus driver was stabbed and a teenager allegedly shot several passengers. That's all ahead on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Shots fired at a Kansas City bus. A Kansas City bus driver attacked. Riding on city buses has become a hazardous occupation of late. We'll talk to an official with the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority in just a bit. Later on today, the latest installment of A Fan's Notes. But first up, Mike Sanders, the Jackson County Executive. Mike has been struggling with a rocky assessment process with county property owners. He's also engaged in a big remodel of the Independence Courthouse, where Harry Truman once worked, and he continues to work on a regional rail system connecting the eastern suburbs of Jackson County with the downtown. And here's some breaking news. Mike announced this morning that he's stepping down from his second job, which is chairman of the Missouri Democratic Party. Mike Sanders, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Steve, thanks for having me.
As I said, Mike, breaking news, you're stepping down as chair of the Missouri Democratic Party. This will happen at the next state committee meeting on August 24th. Why are you stepping down?
You know, and breaking news as of about 10 minutes ago, but, yeah. You know, it's something when I became state party chair in November of 2010, the one thing that we knew is I would do it for a very short amount of time. I told everybody that immediately after the election cycle, I was going to step down. That was in November of 2012. But, I mean, fundraising was going well. We needed to make sure that the party was in a good position to transition to the next chair of the Missouri Democratic Party. So I was asked by party leaders to stick around until after roughly this July. It's July, and so here we are. Wanted to make sure that everything, though, was in good shape leaving. I'll tell you, Steve, you sat next to me at the Jefferson Jackson dinner we had in June, which is the big fundraiser for the state party.
Yeah.
It's a really exciting time, I think, right now. It's kind of bittersweet to be stepping down. It's a very exciting time for Democrats right now. At our JJ dinner, the big fundraiser that we had a record turnout. In an off election cycle, which is unheard of. I mean, this exceeds.
This is over in St. Louis.
Absolutely. Yeah. Over in St. Louis. It exceeds 2008, 2010, 2012. For example, last year, to give you some sort of litmus test as to where we're at, generally you get about 400 people, 400 participants at the dinner. They pay over $100, obviously, to come to the dinner. This year we had 600. We had a full capacity at the Renaissance Hotel in St. Louis.
Why is that? What's spurring the interest in an off election year? Because you're right. Typically, in those off election years, people don't show up to those committee meetings.
They
so
don't.
The state party dinners. Yeah.
They don't. I mean, 400 for 2012. We thought we'd hit somewhere around 300, maybe 350 would be a number. But as people started to RSVP and the numbers went up, we had to expand the room. I don't know really. I mean, we can talk about a number of things that sort of are energizing Democrats around the state. I think Todd Akin's certainly part of it. I think 5 out of 6 seats that we took in 2012 is part of it. But there's really just an energy. I think people see the Republican Party as not your father's Oldsmobile, so to speak. It's not the old school Republican Party. It's a party that sort of lost touch with whatever values, mainstream values they might have had in the 80s or early 90s. That's gone. I mean, this is a party that has tacked so far to the right that people no longer can even begin to identify with many of the things that they're talking about down in Jefferson City. So I think that's certainly part of it. I'll tell you another thing that's been very interesting to me is for the first time that I'm aware of, period, and maybe this has happened in the past, we haven't really tracked it, the Missouri Democratic Party is out fundraising the Republican Party in the state of Missouri. That is rare. I mean, historically, you can count on death and taxes. The sun's going to rise in the east and set in the west, and the Republican Party is going to outraise the Democratic Party across the country. That's not the case here in Missouri.
So if things are rolling so well, Mike, why say goodbye?
Well, I mean, I've got to, at some point, you got to focus on more terrestrial concerns. I've got to look at what's going on in my future as I look at 2014, really, and 16 and beyond. I've got to
next
look at that.
Next year's your reelection year if you choose to run for a third term as
that's
Jackson
right.
County Executive.
And then
yeah.
really beyond that, I mean, as we start to look at opportunities around the state, I mean, what do you do? And look, I mean, in 2012, the pass-through, the total money raised, and a lot of this is attributed to a variety of people, the majority of it, obviously, I mean, the vast majority to Claire McCaskill, but $7 million was raised. We raised just for our operations north of $1 million. That takes a lot of time. I mean, to sit in a room, to raise the money, to do those things, you've got to have the opportunity and really the focus to do that. And so this is a great time. The party's in the black. That isn't how we inherited it, but the party's in the black. There's plenty of money in the bank. They can make payroll. They've got staff in place. And so I think it's the perfect time to really transition after all the fundraising.
We'll talk about your future sure. in just a moment. You know, state party chairs are measured on several measuring sticks, one of which is how much money you raise. You just talked about that. The other is races you win. And last year, Democrats, at least statewide, had a pretty good year, as you already alluded to. You won a U.S. Senate seat. You reelected a governor. Those are probably the two most important things a chairman has to worry about. You got to feel, I guess, pretty good about that.
Yeah, you really lay awake at night thinking about this. And when we took over the party less than a year before the election cycle, I think as we talked about at the time, I think I might talk about on the show. I mean, I think the conventional wisdom was, you'll win one, maybe two of those seats. I think the AG seat and the governor seat were two seats people assumed you'd win. I think everything else was at best a jump ball and up for grabs. So to look at five out of six, I think, is really something we can look back on with a lot of pride. But let's talk about why that happens. I think we've already talked a bit about that. You look at the quality of candidates on the Republican side and really juxtapose that with the quality of candidates on the Democratic side. I mean, let's look top to bottom. Claire McCaskill, what an amazing campaign. What an amazing elected official. Governor Nixon, Chris Koster, Jason Kander. You look at all the Clint Zweifel, obviously. I mean, you look at the quality candidates we have on the Democratic side. I know I'm partisan, but at the end of the day, if you stack them up, there's just no comparison with the people.
Well, that's happening, but yet at the state House level, Republicans dominate, Mike, and that's becoming a growing concern from Democratic Party members. Republicans have veto-proof majorities in both the state House and the state Senate. So why would you be doing so well statewide, but then apparently not doing as well at the state House
level? And I think that is absolutely the question. Now, is the state Democratic Party? We had very little to do with House and Senate races in 2012. 2014, that changes. We've got one statewide race, and that's the race for auditor, right? We'll field a candidate. The Democrats will field a candidate. And so 14 really is going to become the year where we focus on Missouri House. We as a party focus on Missouri House and Missouri Senate seats. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. Democrats can run and win in rural areas. Democrats can run and win all across this state. Claire's shown it. Jay's shown it. Chris has shown it. Clint's shown it. We can do that. So it really comes down to several things. Fundraising, obviously, is very critical. But beyond that, it really is being a party that's very data-driven, data-focused, and fielding candidates that can win in these areas. That's the basic blocking and tackling of politics. That's fielding candidates that can run and win in these districts, in areas where, frankly, you have Republicans that have tracked and no longer tack with the majority of people in those districts. I think 2014 poses for us an incredibly rich opportunity to begin the process of taking about House and Senate seats. Now, I'll tell you, in the last cycle, we picked up two Senate seats, right, on the Democratic side. That, I think, becomes the model for what I think you're going to look at in 2014.
It's a pretty strange deal that you do so well statewide and yet getting crushed outstate Missouri. You look at a map of a statewide map of Missouri and the General Assembly and the seats Republicans hold. The state is bright red from sea to shining sea, save for St. Louis and Kansas City, with maybe just a couple small exceptions.
Yeah. That's it. And so I think that comes down to the basic blocking and tackling. Candidate recruitment, fundraising, but not conceding rural areas, not conceding areas in rural Missouri where Democrats have run and won as late as 2012. So being very data-driven, very, very, very focused, very logical about this. But that is going to be the focus of 2014. And I'll be here to help. Obviously, there'll be a new chair, which will help sort of quarterback the new direction in terms of looking at that focus. I mean, statewide, that was the ball game in 2012. The ball game in 2014 are going to be House and Senate seats. And I think there are a number of very ripe Democratic performing seats, Democratic leaning seats that are currently held by Republicans that don't track with their districts that I think are ripe for the Democrats to seize back in 2014.
Let's talk about the new chairman for a moment. I've reported that Roy Temple, a former chief of staff to Governor Mel Carnahan, a chief of staff to former Senator Gene Carnahan, very much in the running for that. Is that who the next chairman's going to be, Mike?
Right now, I'm stepping down, so that's something that's going to have to be determined by the 64 members of the Missouri State Party. They have to come together. They'll come together on the 24th, and they'll express whomever it is they want to pick. That is the process. It's a very democratic process, very open process. If you look at there are a number of people who have expressed interest. I think the one and there are a number, but I think the one name that has been out there publicly is Roy Temple. Look, Roy's a very smart guy. Roy's been very successful within the party.
He's very aggressive when it comes to Republicans,
Very much so.
He chews them for breakfast, I think. That's what Roy Temple's known for, I think.
Absolutely. Roy's going to bring a good energy as you start to look at, if he is the chair, if you start to look at 2014, I think Roy is a person that can bring a lot of energy into 2014. But it really does come back to candidate recruitment, raising money. It's not sexy. It's a lot of work, but that's the basic blocking and tackling. So if Roy winds up being the person, and we'll see, that'll play out over the next few weeks, I think he'd make an excellent chair.
So we're visiting with Mike Sanders, the Jackson County executive. So, Mike, what is your political future? Again, I just mentioned a few minutes ago, you're up for reelection next year if you choose to run for a third term as Jackson County executive. Are you going there? And then what might be ahead?
Well, I mean, I think that's something that I can just sort of dodge at the moment, if that's okay. I mean, I think there are a number of opportunities that are out there that we want to look at. I mean, I think I've made it very, very clear that I'm going to run for a third term as county executive. You know, beyond that, let's just see. I mean, I think that the one thing that at some level was unanticipated, but I guess very logical consequence of being state chair is you get to travel the state, meet a lot of people, see how big this state is, but also at some level how small this state is. Mm-hmm. And how you really start to think about the state in a much bigger picture. And so, you know, is that something that's in the cards in the future? I mean, that's something I got to sit down with my family, talk to my wife about. It's something we would have to make a decision as a family. But what the future holds, we'll just wait and see. I mean, I think there are a number of opportunities out there, and what we decide to do will obviously announce sometime in the future.
Okay. Again, we're visiting with Mike Sanders, the Jackson County executive. Let's move on to some issues that you've been up against in your role as Jackson County executive, Mike. Let's begin with the assessment process that's caused you and property owners so many headaches the last few months. Tens of thousands of assessments were said to be suspect, and yet this week, when the deadline came for appeals of those assessments, fewer than 3,000 formal appeals came through the door. That may sound like a lot. We'll talk in a minute. That really isn't much compared to other previous assessment years. What explains it? Why so few?
Yeah, and let's kind of take it from the beginning, I guess. But to start with your numbers question, 5,700 was the appeal number, the formal appeal number. And this is all a process, informal and formal. But for the formal appeals, people that want to formally appeal to
them. It was 5,700 in 2011.
2011, that's right.
But this time fewer than 3,000, right?
That's the number the Board of Equalization Chair reported.
Okay.
And understand, these are numbers that are with a state statutorily created agency, the Board of Equalization, that's created by state statute that ultimately hears appeals out of every county across mm-hmm. the state. So the BOE chair, a guy by the name of Robert Murphy, came to the legislature on Monday and said they anticipate roughly 3,000 formal appeals, 5,700 in 2011, and the number was over 7,000, I think, in 2009. So that number is way down. So with all the – so you have to go back and sort of recreate what has occurred. Now, if you look at the initial – notices that went out, and that's what they were, initial notices.
Yeah.
There were issues with the initial notices. The assessment staff worked very hard to correct those, some of the errors that I believe occurred. We instructed them to go back and fix that, to correct that, brought in a number of people to look at that. They worked very, very hard, and I got to give all the credit to the assessment department, to the people that work there. There were nights where I know they were leaving at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning over not a period of days, but over a period of weeks to make sure that all this work got done, that those assessments got corrected, that they were accurate.
Because the number of questionable assessments totaled tens of thousands at 1 point.
58,000, I think, is ultimately the number that the assessment department thought they had to relook at. Now, that doesn't mean that they were all incorrect or inaccurate. That's the number that they reevaluated mm-hmm. in terms of their evaluation, the number they thought was accurate in terms of looking at, right? They looked at 58,000. So out of that, you expect, out of any assessment cycle, you expect about 6,000 appeals is what you generally expect, or, mm-hmm. or certainly more than 3,000. So that's an interesting number. But once again, that shows the number of people that feel like they want to take it to the formal appeals process. But, Steve, I want to emphasize, this is a process. It goes on. The actual tax notices don't go out and bills don't go out until roughly December of this year. So there's a lot of time to look at this. The Board of Equalization will do its work. And in the meantime, what I'm going to continue to do is instruct the assessment office to go back and look at what happened when those initial notices went out. And some of these values, frankly, I'm going to be very honest, were wildly inconsistent. Now, something else that I think is a broader conversation is, you know, when it started out in the 1980s, it was $6 per parcel at the state of Missouri. And remember now, this is a function that we perform by state statute at the county. The county performs, the assessment department performs state regulation, state guidelines, state tax commission. They dictate roughly how you do this process. And in the past, they provided $6 per parcel to conduct this service for local government. That number is down to $2.82. It's half. I think it's logical to think that there's going to be some issue potentially, as there's been all around the state, when you see that kind of reduction. But beyond that, I think the way that the state has mandated that this process go forward in terms of these assessments, it's archaic, it's cumbersome, it's very expensive. All you have to do is look at states around the union to see cheaper, easier, more efficient, and frankly, more fair ways of conducting these assessments and doing these assessments. I look no further than California, right? Mm-hmm. Look at California where—
That's pretty far away.
It is pretty far away, yeah.
No, for them, pretty it far. Is. Yeah.
But if you look at California and dealing with this issue, right, when you purchase a home, you cap the value at that price, and then ultimately that sets a very easy valuation as to what that is. It removes so much of the subjectivity from the process. But I'll tell you what it does.
The market price of the property.
Absolutely. And doesn't that make sense? Right now, we can't do that in the state of Missouri. Right. We're instructed to do it the way we're instructed
based
to do
on
it.
State law.
Based on state law, absolutely. So that, to me, makes a lot of sense. But I'll tell you what else that does, Steve. It would save millions and millions of dollars all throughout the state because you don't need these massive bureaucracies to go out and subjectively assess these properties. It just makes a lot of sense to sort of, to be novel here, let's get into the 21st century as to how this could be done.
What's holding that process back? Why isn't that happening?
I don't know. I mean, I think you could look at ultimately, you have to ask the folks in Jeff City as to why they want to continue to do it this way. We continue to be very vocal advocates to dramatically change the way assessments are done. You know, once again, archaic, expensive, cumbersome, subjective. Makes sense to remove all that from the process, save money, and that money could be used for a variety of purposes around the state.
So you're saying of these 58,000 appraisals that you thought were somewhat suspect, you're basically saying that the county assessor, Curtis Coons, and his staff just worked their tails off to go through those and to sort of deal with the issues that those assessments posed at that point.
They did, and I'll tell you what they've told me. And the 58,000 number was their number, but I'll tell you what they have told us and told the legislature was the issue. You take older neighborhoods, which is what we have in Kansas City, and you take newer neighborhoods, Lee Summit, Blue Springs, none of these issues occurred. When you look at issues of comparables for property, there's sort of two ways this process went wrong. Way number one is a computer will pull in a computer model that, by the way, people input the data on. This is people-driven. They take those comparables for property. Well, the problem is going to be if you have a neighborhood where it's just foreclosures, which the State Tax Commission says you can't necessarily use exclusively to determine value. You have to go further and further out from that neighborhood. And so you had areas where they were going 5-10 miles out to pull in comparables. But, Steve, those aren't comparables. That doesn't really tell you the value of that property.
Right.
So it's, garbage in, garbage out. So when those numbers are grabbed, it's not human error. As well as computer error, and those aren't caught, it creates these values.
So, Mike,
that had to
be fixed. You can examine the process the county used and what went wrong, but you're saying that you're ultimately hamstrung by a state law that won't allow you to change the system, at least in Jackson County, to one that has a more market-based approach.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to do it. It's the subjective analysis of what is that property worth, whether there's been a sell or not been a sell. And I think that if you go back to 2007, 5, 3, where it was a very vibrant market, a lot of sales in older neighborhoods, it was much easier to track what the comparables were for a neighborhood. If you now look at it, you have neighborhoods where there hasn't been a sell in 5 or 6 years, right? There are no comparables for particular neighborhoods. That creates even more potential valuation issues for that department and makes it much more tricky.
Mike Sanders, he's the Jackson County Executive. He's our guest for this segment of the show. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address. UpToDate at KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. You know, County Assessor Curtis Coons actually resigned at one point, Mike, although he stayed on to complete this review process you're talking about. Is he still going to be leaving his job?
He is.
Given the fact that you sort of have worked through a lot of these problems?
He is, and he's worked remarkably hard. I'm sorry to report that yesterday he had heart surgery, okay? And I don't want to say the two are linked. But he had surgery the other day, so he's recovering. So, Curtis, if you're listening, get better. But he's going to be around until September. Once again, under State Tax Commission rules, someone signs off on the values. He started the process. He's going to sign off. I think the issue that was reported in the Star was an issue concerning really what we've talked about. And he owned that and ultimately resigned.
Let's move on to the courthouse renovation. The Truman Courthouse in Independence will be rededicated on September 7th following a major renovation. Mike, you've said that this rededication that's coming up on September 7th, it'll be a big day in Independence at the courthouse, brings part of Harry Truman's legacy back to life. How so?
Yeah, it really does. In 1933, September 7, 1933, Harry Truman opened the courthouse on the courthouse square. It's one of the real iconic structures in our community. It had fallen into massive disrepair. millions of dollars in repairs that had not been done since essentially the 1970s, hadn't been a real working courthouse since the 80s. The last judge to leave was Vernon Scovell. He left in the mid-90s, but even then it was – they were literally duct taping things together as he walked out. So it was in very bad repair. Huge issues with the foundation that occurred that we ultimately declared a public emergency on in 2010. We went to the state, to the federal government, thinking Harry Truman's courthouse. Last time I looked, he was a president, right?
Yeah.
Makes some sense that they would have some
the 33rd,
interest.
33rd, I think. Yeah.
Yes, he was. 33rd, 1933, 33rd. Mm-hmm. That's right. No money. I mean, obviously, with the issues with the budget, there was no money in the state, no money in the federal government. And so this is something we had to undertake on our own. Over $5 million in this most recent renovation. It's going to be back to its original scope, its original structure, and it's going to be a working courthouse again in terms of a tourism center, an art gallery, a museum.
Are judges going to be moving back in?
They're not. We're going to have some offices. That's a second part of this, is we're going to expand the annex out east to move more judges in there as population bases move. That's very critical for law enforcement perspectives and court issues and court reasons in the 16th Circuit. But that's going to be opened. Going to open it, by the way, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, September 7, 2013, 80 years to the second from when it was last opened by
wow.
Harry Truman. By the way, can I just say this?
Yes.
Wallace, the architect for the renovations in 1933, was a little-known architect with the last name of Wallace. And I think you, J.D. Wallace, I think you know the name Wallace.
Bess Wallace is Harry's wife.
I think so. And Mr. Wallace was Bess's brother, who was the architect for the courthouse in 1933, selected after it was said in the paper at the time, a very competitive bid process. He was selected. But by the way, I'll tell you, Steve, 212 Delaware, right? Delaware out there in Independence, where Harry Truman lived, was also his address. So how about that? So I was telling someone the other day, so in 1933, it got you a headline in the Star today, would get you indicted that you hired your brother-in-law to be the architect. But it's a little interesting fact.
So the new courthouse will be basically, if I'm hearing you right, Mike, more of a tourism kind of destination?
It will. And you know, we get visitors from all over the world because of Harry Truman, because of that square. We get them from all over the world to come to that area. It's going to be the Historical Society, some basic county offices, Independence Tourism, national parks will be in there with
the
Truman home.
You can walk to the house basically from the courthouse.
Absolutely. Was it two and a half blocks, roughly, to Truman's home. That's part of where he worked. By the way, Clinton's drugstore, where he had his first job, is right across the street from the courthouse. There's a lot of history right there. Upstairs, we're also going to have, we've got local art collectors are going to bring in Binghams, Bentons, Wagners, a lot of local art. Millions of dollars worth of art, that's going to be upstairs as well. So it's going to be, we think, a real attraction. It already is, even though it's closed. It already is. We get visitors from all over the world, every country in the world, and I think it's going to be a great, great thing for the county.
Lots of phone calls for Mike Sanders, the Jackson County Executive. Let's go to some of them now. Samantha from Independence. Samantha, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Samantha. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, first of all, thanks, Mr. Sanders, for all you do for the residents. But I was just wondering, are you planning on making that courthouse after the renovations more functional daily?
Absolutely. It's going to be open daily. I appreciate the question. Thanks for your comment. Absolutely going to be open. Going to be open to the public. We're going to be able to perform weddings out of there, a variety of functions out of there. There's going to be meeting space. It's going to be a functioning courthouse in terms of the public's access, which it really hasn't been since 1995.
Let's go to some questions about the assessment process. Paul from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air. Good morning. You there, Paul? Let's go to Nick from Parkville. Nick, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm from California originally, and Proposition 13 was the law which locked in the property assessment at the value of the last sale.
Right.
It's been a total failure in terms of adequately funding our school system and local improvements. If you want to make a change, California is certainly not the model you want to follow. If you want to get rid of the administrative costs of doing assessments on property by property, okay, go to some sort of escalator like the Consumer Price Index or an index of property values in some larger metropolitan areas around the state, like that.
Nick, why doesn't the market value model work? What's the issue there?
What they do is they lock in the amount of tax that you pay each month, and so there's no escalation in tax revenues over time, even though property values may tremendously escalate, and they have no capacity to increase the rate per mill that they charge as tax. It just does not work.
Well, that's California. Okay, we're a little bit different here in Missouri. Now, I'll tell you this. I think the argument you make is the problem, is the issue with California, if there's no other source of income, obviously, for school districts. I go back and look at what is the fairest and best way to pay for education in the state of Missouri. The archaic way of doing it by doing it almost solely through assessments on real estate maybe isn't the best way to do it, which is your point. It's not a problem with the way the valuation is done. It's a problem with how schools are funded, right? So I think those are two separate arguments.
That may be the case. But now if you're talking about
Let me just say this. And that is, if you look at, and I look at my community of Jackson County, and I look at ways, let's look at it as a matter of public policy, ways to promote people to stay in an area, right? Let's take people on fixed incomes. Let's take people that are over the age of 65. Does it make sense that I bought a house in 1975 and I continue to see this dramatic rise in my property values? If I'm allowed to freeze that or capture that, it promotes people staying in neighborhoods for a longer period of time, which is great for Jackson County and Kansas City.
I think
more residents is a good thing, sir.
You're not talking about your majority of the population. Okay. You want to keep the majority of your population, and they're dependent upon good services.
All right, Nick, I'm going to have to cut you off. I have a call here from a surprise caller here this morning. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill joins us now. Senator, good morning.
Good morning. I just want you to know, Steve, that I was sitting in a Democratic caucus with the president. And he is in there right now speaking to all of us and answering everybody's questions and having great conversations. And I said, I got to duck out of the room for a minute because I have to make a call and publicly thank Mike Sanders for doing a terrific job.
I'm glad you got your priorities straight, Senator.
For the last months, and it's a thankless job. Everyone has a complaint. No one is willing sometimes to step forward and do this job. And he had another big job. He was doing very well and managed to take this on also. And I just wanted to call and publicly on your show and let the people of Jackson County know that they've got a winner and Mike Sanders is a leader. And we are very grateful to the leadership he provided the state party.
Well, God bless you, boss. I appreciate that very much. But I don't know if you hit your head coming out of the shower, but you should be with the president. So, but thank you so much. It's an honor. You know, Steve, this is the best boss I ever had and gave me my first job as a lawyer was Claire, October 25th, 1994. But by the way, hired my wife the same week. And so we give her credit for putting this together. Probably the best week of my life.
Senator, I'm glad you called. Thanks for taking a minute.
Thanks, Steve.
Talk to you guys soon. You too. Bye-bye. Going back to the assessment process after that very nice phone call, Kay writes to us at UpToDate@KCUR.org, limiting changes in valuation to only when properties change hands or have additions is simple, but it's bad policy, she writes. Properties that are held for a long time end up paying disproportionately little, and those owning starter homes end up paying more. The process of annual appraisals may be complicated, but it's ultimately more fair. It may be a good idea to use statistical models more rather than site visits, she writes.
Well, and that's essentially what they do now. It's very expensive. It's very cumbersome. I think this is just a broader debate as to what we do. Now, I would say for someone that makes that argument, they need to come down to my office and talk to elderly, senior citizens, people that have been in those homes or living on fixed income, and ways that we can provide tax relief for those individuals that have been in neighborhoods for a long period of time. I think it really strikes us hard in the urban core of Kansas City with gentrification to some of the neighborhoods. And so there's no great answer. There's no perfect answer to this. If there was, I think it probably already would have
occurred. It's more complicated than it seems, at least on the surface.
Very much so.
Yeah. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Mike Sanders. Good morning. You there, Mike? He had a question.
Hello,
about...
hey.
Yeah, Mike,
yeah,
go ahead.
Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me on. Mr. Sanders, thanks for everything you've done for us.
Thank you.
My question has to do with transit, and I was pretty fired up about the commuter rail program, and I was just kind of wondering where we're at with that now.
Very good question. You're taking it right out of my mouth, Mike. Mike Sanders, go ahead.
Mike, you got a great first name, first off. thanks for the question. Transit, what I would say is stay tuned for the next couple of months. I think there may be some interesting announcements on transit coming forward. We have had a lot of conversations, none of which have occurred in the public domain at this point, but I think there's a lot that may be developing here in the next couple of months, so just stay tuned. Transit is going to continue to be mass transit, one of the big agenda items as to how we remain competitive in a global economy going forward. I'll tell you one great stat, Steve.
Yeah.
You take people under the age of 35. They did a poll at the University of Michigan. It was an oft-cited poll. Of those individuals, they were asked, would you rather give up your iPhone? Would you rather have a new iPhone or a new car? Right? 65% of people under the age of 35 said they would rather have the new iPhone than a brand new car, than their car.
Yeah.
It's a paradigm shift. It's a change in the model for how things function and how we function as a society. And for the first time, fewer and fewer people are even seeking driver's licenses. 28% of new driver's age individuals are now seeking driver's licenses. Steve, when you and I were kids, that's been a few years.
Everybody,
we all saw that.
You rushed in.
It was the rite of passage, right? Now it's 28% or even seeking a driver's license. So we got to be thinking about how we plan for that, how we plan for the next generation, the new paradigm, the new economy going forward.
And what we're talking about here, just so everyone's on board, a regional rail system that connects the eastern suburbs of Jackson County with downtown Kansas City in very broad terms.
Absolutely,
right?
Bringing people downtown, reinvigorating downtown communities. If you look at people that have done this or communities that have done this around the country, it revitalizes the urban core, it revitalizes downtown areas. And it really energizes the economy of those local areas. The value and the thing that we can do here locally is we have so many railroad partners here that we can do it, so to speak, on the cheap. We can have the same levels of service as other communities and do it for roughly, 10, 15, 20% of what other communities would have done it for. 44 miles for less than $600 million if we ultimately get this all put together, get the deals all inked and done, which is what we want to make sure we do before we go public with this.
Yeah.
That's a remarkable thing to be able to accomplish, and we can do it, therefore, without huge amounts of federal funding and change our city going forward.
You're still talking about a one-set increase in the sales tax to get this done, Mike. Is that still part of this plan?
Well, we'll see. I mean, let's see ultimately what we get done with the railroads, what the deal looks like, what the cost of construction are, and piece this all together. The 1 cent is what's allowed by state statute. What we would ultimately do down the road, that just remains to be seen. It could be that. It could be less. I mean, that's just the capacity that we have down the road. But what you would want to make sure you do, Steve, you want to make sure you pay for the operating, for the capital, for all the construction and future expansion down the road.
Yeah.
Do it all under one roof so you don't make the mistakes other communities have made where you fund it at one level up front and every several years have to come back and ask for more and more and more. Want to make sure that doesn't happen.
So it sounds like you're saying you can't give many details right now, but I'm gleaning from what you're saying that progress is ongoing.
Absolutely ongoing. Negotiations continue to be ongoing. We've got some great railroad partners that we're working with. I think all of this has to be done, though, quietly, methodically. That's what's going on. And then when I think we're ready to make an announcement, which my hope is here in the next few months, one of those announcements may occur. That'll be the time to sort of begin to lay this out.
Well, quiet, methodical, Mike Sanders, thank you for coming in and taking some time.
Thanks, Steve.
Always good to have you, Mike.
Thanks.